That way, this beautiful place will be beautiful forever. And we'll make sure that closing your eyes will never be the only way to get there. I'm Paul Newman. Help the Nature Conservancy save the last great places.
Visit the Nature Conservancy at nature.org. That's nature.org.
So good to hear from Paul again. Where has he been? It's 6 o'clock. Excuse me. 6 o'clock. You're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook. It's time for Off the Wall. Okay, so that's how it's going to be, CD player. All right. Our theme is going to be skipping tonight, apparently, because it's in a very frolicky mood. Okay, you know, we can play that, too. We are kind of pressed for time ourselves. We have so many things to cover tonight. We weren't on last week, and guess what? We won't be on next week, and guess what? We won't be on the week after that. So we have a lot to cover, and if our theme doesn't want to cooperate, fine, so be it. This is Emmanuel. The show is Off the Wall, joined tonight by Kyle.
I'm here, too.
Yes, and hopefully you, the listener, are there. If you're not, you don't know about it, so it works either way.
I'm going to make a new copy of this theme song.
Oh, you're blaming the CD, not the CD player.
Well, I just think it's been through enough.
Yeah, we have been using that since the first days of Trump.
The lasers have finally won out, and... It can't take any more photons.
Uh-huh. Maybe that's the case. We'll figure it out. We'll have time to figure it out because we won't be on until March, until not even the first week of March, the second week of March. Why? Because they're playing games here at the campus of State University at Stony Brook. All kinds of games, whether it's soccer, lacrosse, tennis, basketball, baseball, football. Did I mention lacrosse? They're doing that a lot. And when they play a game, we feel obligated to cover it.
Yeah, and the esports league is starting up this year too. So Stony Brook is going to have a whole team of people playing multiplayer games.
I don't know. Are you joking? Is that really a thing?
They
here?
Built that. That's what that enormous structure is on the sports field out there. That's just for esports.
Wait.
They've got a bunch of recliners and big TVs and yeah.
Okay, you're joking. You are joking. I think you're joking. Because it's possible you're not joking, but the weirdest thing about that, if you weren't joking, would be that they would move all the esports people out onto the athletic fields. In fact, they would destroy athletic fields so that they could put esports people there so they could sit in their chairs and watch TV. That would be weird. That would be funny.
Well, sometimes they stand.
But it's no more ridiculous than what's really going on. I'm sorry. I'm going to offend a lot of people by saying I don't think esports are sports. I don't think you're an athlete by sitting in a chair and pressing buttons with your thumb. I mean, you're good at that, yeah, and I don't want to take that away from you, but you're not an athlete. You're not getting out of breath and getting into better shape physically. I'm sorry, you're just not.
I feel like the sports show should do like an entire special on exactly what defines athletics.
No, it should be an esports section. That's what they should be. Let's push for that. Let's go all the way up to the second tier of the programming council here at the radio station. We have five tiers total. You don't get to the high council. You get to the second tier. The high council, we shouldn't even be talking about that. But you get all the way to that point, and then, you know, if you get the approval for the esports section to be on the air, then you say, just kidding, we had no intention of doing that. And then they'll assign it to you, and you'll have to do it. That's how the sports section got started.
I thought just preempting for tournaments.
They wanted
to play
new wave music, and they wound up doing a sports show instead. That's how things happen here. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't mean disrespect to people who are into esports, but come on, let's just be real here. I don't get exercise either, and I don't pretend like I do. So there.
That's not saying quite as much as I think you think it is, but
No, you're right.
Well, so in any event, we could be preempted by that. I mean, how would we feel if we got preempted by a
Why do you need a building
gaming?
For esports? Why can't you just do it from your house? I don't get that.
Well, I think they have a trough where they feed from, so they can just keep the.
All right. Well, you just passed me in the offensiveness category, so I'm fine.
They just have
I feel
the
good.
The grain and the corn feeding
anyway,
continually.
We're not on next week or the week after. At this rate, maybe not the week after that. But
sports will be in our stead.
Yeah, we've made that clear. But let's talk about things that have been going on, because we haven't had a chance, since we haven't been here, to talk about the various things that are happening, and we won't have much of a chance tonight, and we won't have any chance in the next couple of weeks. Politics, wow, isn't that something? Boy, this country is sure messed up, and I don't know where it's going to go.
We should all do something, very quickly.
Everybody.
And everybody, big protests.
Iowa, New Hampshire.
Hundreds of people.
So two whitest states in the union managed to define who the candidates are going to be, and... watching the returns last week, because there were returns last week as opposed to the week before that, what I got out of it was, wow, what an amazing week for Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, and what a disappointing win for Bernie Sanders. You know, that's pretty much what they were saying. He won, and all people could do is tear him down. It's really something. Of course, watching the defensiveness of Bernie Sanders supporters is also kind of funny.
A little scary, too.
It's a little scary. Well, I'm not sure why it's scary, but it doesn't bode well for the future, because here's the thing. You have Buttigieg, you've got Bernie, you've got Biden, and now you've got Bloom. What's with the Bs? Everything is a B. What's going on with that?
Buttigieg.
Huh. I just realized that. And wasn't there another one that just dropped out that began with a B, too?
Oh, yeah, Bennett.
Bennett, yeah. Boy, there's something weird going on.
Okay, well, don't get distracted with that. I mean, it's just names, letters.
I'll look into that after the show. But, okay, so you have all these people, and, yeah, the Bloomberg thing is disturbing. Multi-billionaire coming in and trying to buy the whole thing. But here's what we have to never lose sight of, okay? If your candidate doesn't get it... Whatever candidate does get it, and I don't care if it's Biden, I don't care if it's Bloomberg, I don't care if it's Buttigieg, I don't care, you know, if it's anybody else that has a D in parentheses after their name, you vote for that person over the other one. And if you don't, you're the problem, not the other people, because they're doing exactly what we expect them to do. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to do, what they believe in. God bless them. But if we don't get our candidate and we stay home as a result of that, yeah, you're pretty much handing the country over to God knows what. And it's not just an unpopular candidate, somebody you don't like. It's the Supreme Court. It's Roe versus Wade. It's the environment. It's a million things that will be affected as a result. So please, people, make sure you're able to set that aside. And as our theme stutters to an end.
Don't forget to point out the class dichotomy there too. I mean, this is about most everyone, mm-hmm. and then the sort of swampy, powerful things—the very thing that we were supposed to be getting rid of—it
right.
just seems to be getting fed.
Yes,
we're
that always happens.
The processes in Washington have just continued on, and it's going to end up leaving you behind, us, the many.
Look, we just heard this whole big expose on Biden, on Democracy Now, and that's great. But keep in mind, if he winds up being the candidate, He's still far better than the alternative, the other side, and the things that will happen there. And if we put ourselves in a position where we can't, under any circumstance, vote for the other person in the same party, we're setting ourselves up for failure. We don't need help from the other side. Now, you know, there's all kinds of things I can say about everybody. I was arrested under Bloomberg, you know, during RNC 2004. He was the one that gave the command to arrest anybody on the streets. It was terrible. But I still would choose him over Trump any day, because what will happen under him will be steps, at least. It won't be all the steps I want at once, but it'll be something. And it won't be what we're doing right now. And I won't be happy about it. I certainly won't be happy about it. I don't expect to be happy about anything, you know, because the way this is going, it's always the candidate you really don't want that seems to get more votes. You know, after what happened yesterday with the so-called moderate Democrats in Virginia, do you hear about this? The governor had this bill all ready to go to ban assault weapons. Isn't that amazing? In Virginia. And who is it who killed the bill? Democrats, moderate Democrats killed the bill. If it wasn't for them, would have gone through. This is why you can't trust moderate Democrats to act like Democrats. They'll act like Republicans more because they're trying to appeal to Republicans for some reason.
Yeah, they'll walk that line carefully at the wrong time.
But that said, if it's a moderate Democrat versus a fascist Republican, I'll go for the moderate Democrat. Won't be happy about it, but I will do that. And as long as we're all on that page, we'll be all right, because we'll take tiny steps in the right direction as opposed to big steps, but we will take steps as opposed to being pushed into the other direction. So anyway, we have a special story we want to share with you tonight as one feature of a couple of things we're doing. This is something actually that we taped a couple of weeks ago, but we weren't on, so we weren't able to broadcast it till now. But it's an amazing story. It's something that we were a part of a little over a year ago, actually. In fact, it was on December 11th, 2018, that we were on the Queen Mary 2. Remember that, Kyle?
I do.
Yeah, we were taking the boat from Brooklyn to Southampton, not Southampton out east on Long Island, Southampton in England.
It's a ship.
Yeah, it's a big ship. It's the world's only ocean liner, meaning it's the world's only boat that goes from point A to point B across an ocean, as opposed to just a cruise that you circle around and you get a coronavirus or whatever.
Meander.
You notice how it's only the cruise ships that are getting coronaviruses and not an ocean liner. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I hear that because it's been described as a petri dish. But at the same time, I'm like, well, I mean, if that many people, even on a cruise ship that are being like separated, if that many people get it, I mean, it's still a pretty nasty virus,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that it's able to just kind of spread around like that. And I don't want to be dismissive of the ferocity.
Look. Here's the message. You done pissed off Mother Nature. This is what happens. This is how things get set right. So keep that in mind. She can always come around and just smite a whole bunch of us, and then you got the 1919 flu all over again. It could happen. So, yeah, better think twice. But yeah. Here's something else. You can't catch coronavirus from Chinese people. So let's stop with the ignorance that I'm seeing already starting to manifest itself. Chinese restaurants are suffering as a result of this. Can you believe the stupidity? It's insane. And I know this because there are so many good Chinese places around Stony Brook. And we try to go to all of them because there's a lot of really good, like, authentic, super spicy, knock-you-on-your-ass food.
And stuff on the menu you can't find.
Things that you did not have when you were growing up as a kid, certainly around here. And they're always so incredibly happy to see us. I mean, nobody should be that happy to see us, but they really have been over the past couple of weeks because people aren't going there. It's the stupidest thing. If you have Chinese people in your life, they need you to be around them now because, wow, the ignorance I'm seeing from people that are just trying to distance themselves as if nationality has anything to do with this. It's a location, and you're not in that location, so you're probably fine.
Get good information.
Yeah.
There's so much misinformation and, like, conspiracies going around on social media and stuff, as usual, but... capitalizing on this, it's really disastrous.
Well, look at this. I plucked us off our boat from 2018. And okay, back away from the present. Let's go to the past. December 11th, 2018. We were on the Queen Mary II. We were halfway across the ocean, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And what did we do? We had a Club Mate bottle with us, a glass Club Mate bottle. Did not have Club Mate soda that we bring in from Germany. We had finished that.
We removed it.
We removed the beverage from within it, and we just had an empty bottle, a dry empty bottle, and we stuck a note inside that bottle. And I'm going to read you what the note said. It's on a piece of paper inside an envelope. And it said, "Greetings. You have found our message in a bottle, which was dropped in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean on December 11th, 2018, from the Queen Mary II on its voyage from New York to England. We will award you the equivalent of US$1,000 if you contact us with the contents of this message. In addition, we will also donate the equivalent of US$1,000 to an organization of your choice that helps to keep our oceans clean. We feel a bit guilty for having dropped the bottle into the ocean, but we also thought the resulting communications might be worth it. While it's likely this bottle will never be found, it's also possible this will serve as a small time capsule from one point in history to another. 2018 is proving to be a pivotal and volatile year in our history, and we hope that anyone reading this in the future, whether in 2 weeks or 500 years, will have learned from our mistakes and made some great advancements. In case it's not clear, or you're in a year where nobody remembers, 2600 Magazine is a publication by, for, and about computer hackers." This letter was written on 2600 stationery. We test technology, question authority, and push the limits. Hopefully people still do that whenever this message is read. And if we're still around, the address above should work if we've kept paying for the post office box. You can also try reaching us via email, if that still exists, at addresses like info@2600.com, webmaster@2600.com, and I found the bottle in the ocean at 2600.com. It works. I tested it. The phone number above should also still work if phones exist and we've kept paying the bill. We've put this message inside one of our prepaid envelopes, which won't work outside the United States, incidentally. In order to protect the letters from fading in the inevitable sunlight the bottle will be exposed to. And speaking of the bottle, don't feel too bad if you broke it to get to this message. We sympathize with your eagerness. But we were quite proud of this bottle and its cap, which apparently helped keep water out quite effectively. It once contained a beverage known as Club Mate, which is a German energy drink. Perhaps remnants of its labels on the bottle are still visible. We thought we might get a bit more mileage out of the bottle by tossing it overboard and seeing what happened. Anyway, that's about the whole story. We'll be astounded if anyone actually reads this in our lifetime. And our descendants will also be a bit surprised since we don't plan on telling them. Whatever the scenario, you have some real history on your hands. Or tentacles, etc., if the humans are no longer around. Signed, the 2600 team of mischief and exploration. Well, that note was put in the bottle. Dropped in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean on December 11th, 2018.
A very stormy evening in the North Atlantic Sea.
It wasn't a good night to jump in and take a swim. No.
There was wind. It was lapping and rough and churning, and the spray of the sea was...
All right, Jack London there. Come on. Yeah, it was... But, you know, I think it's always like that in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I don't think it's ever just calm.
Yeah, there's no such thing as like a still
The ocean North is Atlantic. Always angry. So anyway, we dropped that into the water. Do you remember that night when we did that?
I do. Yeah. No, it was harrowing.
Remember trying to talk me out of it?
I was skeptical about the whole thing. I had reservations. I didn't really know how I could help.
Well, you know, you're not supposed to do that. I mean, it's nothing like tossing over plastic bottles or lots of garbage or things like that. It's one single bottle, but I still felt guilty about it. And there are signs that say don't toss things into the ocean. I didn't want to. You know, I didn't want the captain to catch me and put me on a dinghy and like set me adrift.
Well, yeah, maybe they toss you.
I don't know what the penalty is, but I know it gets pretty severe out there.
Well, we were also enjoying our adventure, and the ship itself was quite good to us. There's no reason to be littering, and if everybody did this, it would be I think, catastrophic as far as how much stuff would end up in the sea. So if there's a reason they have those
postings. Everybody did everything, yes, it would always be a problem no matter what it was. I never really buy into that argument if everybody did it, because everybody doesn't do it. In fact, nobody does it. Virtually nobody does it. But okay, yeah, I get it. I felt guilty about it. I did feel guilty. I was afraid maybe some whale, without checking what he was swallowing, might swallow the bottle. But whales are smart. I think, yeah, I don't know. It was glass. I felt better about that than throwing a plastic bottle into the water. I would never do that. But in any event, it's the only thing I ever threw into the ocean, really, seriously, that I know of. Right? You've never seen me throw things into the ocean.
Intentionally, yeah.
I throw a rock into the ocean, but I think that's okay. From the beach.
Some of maybe your municipal waste has ended up in the sea.
Anyway, on February 2nd of this year, this month in fact, we got an email. We got an email from somebody who found our bottle. They found the bottle over a year and a couple of months after it was tossed into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in the Shetland Islands, a place known as Shetland, part of Scotland, north of Scotland. I've learned so much about this place. Yeah, it was simply incredible. A guy named Henry Anderton wrote to us and said, "Hey, I was cleaning the beach. I found your bottle." And it was just simply the most amazing thing. We had to verify that, in fact, this was authentic. But everything pointed to it, yes, being very authentic. And we had a nice conversation with Henry. And here's what he had to say. Well, Henry, congratulations, first of all, on finding the bottle.
Yeah. It's quite extraordinary. It must have come up on the Gulf Stream.
Can you describe what you were doing on Sunday morning when you discovered the bottle?
Yeah, I'd been putting feed blocks out to the sheep, and it was a beautiful day, so I thought I'd go along the beaches and have a look and pick up plastic bottles and rope and all the plastic rubbish that gets washed up. And I just came across this glass bottle, and I saw, oh, there's a message in there. So I took it home and opened it up, and this message from 2600.
Was this the first message in a bottle you've ever found?
No, I found one some years ago. A lad from Newcastle-on-Tyne had been on a holiday in Orkney, and he'd dropped it in the ocean, and it washed up in more or less the same place. But I wrote to them, but never heard anything back from them.
Was that further away than where we dropped our bottle?
Oh, no. Newcastle-on-Tyne is just south of Edinburgh, you know, about 50 or 60 miles south of Edinburgh.
Wow, so this is not the first time you found one. Is trash and other bottles like this, is that a phenomena that's always has always been occurring there on the shoreline?
We get quite a lot of rubbish coming ashore. It seems to come from all over the world. A lot from Scandinavia, a lot from the Caribbean. A lot of shotgun cartridges, spent ones. Probably from the cruise liners doing shooting on board. We get a lot of rubbish. In Shetland, we have what we call the Vore Redup. It's the spring cleanup, but it's easier for me to go around every week or 10 days and gather up, and then it's not such a big job in the spring.
Has waste like this been more of a problem, would you say, or is it improving at all?
No, it hasn't changed very much over the years. There are teams of volunteers go around the shores of Shetland every spring, and they probably gather about 80 tons of rubbish. But I prefer to go and collect on a more regular basis, and it's a lot easier for me to do that. I'll get 2 or 3 bags of rubbish a week.
I still can't get over the shotgun shells you're finding. They do that on ocean liners or cruises, you said?
Yeah, I think they do clay pigeon shooting off the back of ocean liners, and so we get a lot of shotgun cartridges coming up, and the inserts and so on. We get toothbrushes, we get shoes, we get Wellington boots, all sorts of rope, nets, pallets, everything. Nothing surprises me anymore.
What would you say is the most unusual thing you found?
Oh, heavens. Well, I don't think there's been anything unusual, but it is quite exciting to find a message in a bottle, and this is the second one I found. I've been up here for 50 years now, and, you know, in all that time I only found two messages.
And what condition was the bottle in when you found it?
Oh, perfect. I mean, it wasn't broken at all. And in fact, it's all packed up, ready to send back to you. I just have to go to the post office and find out how much it's going to cost to send it. But it's not very heavy. But the top was intact, and so the message was dry. And I've returned the letter and the envelope so you can see what like it is.
Well, just make sure that it's packed nice and firmly. We don't want it to break on its second voyage across the Atlantic Ocean.
If it survived a year and a month in the sea, I think it'll arrive back in New York in one piece.
Well, you don't know our postal service, but fingers crossed.
You say you live there for 50 years. Are you from there?
Well, I was born in North London, raised in Ireland, and I traveled around the world back in the 60s. I was in America for 6.5 months, 7 months. And they tried to send me to Vietnam. I didn't particularly want to go there, so I went to New Zealand instead. And then I came home eventually.
What kind of work were you doing? Were you in...
I was on farm work all the time. I did 2 years at agricultural college down in England. And then I inherited an island in Shetland in 1969. So that's what brought me up here.
You inherited an island?
Yeah, 750-acre island with a Scottish baronial-style mansion house on it. And well, you know, it was 100 years on. It was built by my great-uncle. He was in the wool business back in Yorkshire, and this was his holiday residence for the summer. And so it was a big mansion house, and I couldn't afford to keep it. So I put the place on the market. It took me 13 years to find a customer. And so they bought it 23-24 years ago.
So you ended up settling in Shetland there. Are there a lot of other residents, and what's life like there?
Oh, well, we think it's lovely. There's a population of about 23,000. We're a pretty tight-knit community. There's main industry is aquaculture, fishing, oil, of course. Farming, crafting, knitting, all those kind of things.
Can you tell us just a little bit more about the beaches and the landscape there, where you live and the community?
Yeah, it's all pretty wild and rugged. Most people who come here really enjoy it. It's a bonus, of course, if they get good weather. In the wintertime, we get a lot of wind and rain. So that can be quite taxing on the soul, but for the most part, you know, the summers are wonderful. We have 24 hours of daylight, and so that's great. But of course, in the winter, we only have about 8 hours of daylight. So it can be pretty dark, and especially if it's wet and overcast, then it can, you know, be a bit depressing. But we just get on with it and do what we have to do.
What would you say your favorite part of life is there, personally?
Oh, for the most part, where I am, the peace and quiet. You know, there's if we drive into the main town, which is about 35, 40 minutes away, you know, if you pass half a dozen cars on your way in, it's busy today. But, of course, as you get closer to Lerwick, it's it gets a bit, you know, a bit more traffic.
Lerwick is main town?
Lerwick is the main town, yeah. Have you looked at Shetland on the map?
Yeah, we took a look at the map and are learning quite a bit.
Yeah.
When you're not helping clean up, what kinds of things do you do for fun or hobbies?
Well, I'm retired now, so I'll be 77 in August. So, no, we'd do a bit of socializing. There's always something going on in the local village, and we've just had our big fire festival called Upheliar. You should put that into Google and see. That's the biggest fire festival in Europe. And it's supposed to be an old Viking tradition welcoming back the longer daylight hours. Probably stems from celebrating the end of the, you know, the winter solstice. But it's always the last Tuesday in January, and it's become internationally known now. And we get people from all over the world coming to visit it.
Well, Henry, when we toss the bottle into the ocean, we offer to whoever found it a $1,000 reward. What will you be spending your $1,000 on?
Well, I've just acquired one of these old-fashioned red telephone kiosks from British Telecom. Because of the improvements in the mobile network, nobody is using these telephone boxes anymore. So they've taken out the equipment, and we've bought the box, but we're going to have to spend about £3,000 on restoring it because it lost its door in a gale two winters ago. So we have to buy a new door, which is £1,000, and then we have to buy new stuff to go inside to support the windows and so on, and then we have to paint it up, and hopefully we'll get onto that in the summer.
You know, we publish a magazine that features payphones and payphone kiosks, so the odds of somebody finding our bottle who is also into that are simply astronomical.
Yeah, yeah. What is this, phone box kiosks in the States, or...?
Well, there are some. There's one in Port Jefferson, and I think the one you sent us a picture of actually looks in better shape than that one, so maybe they need to spend some money and fix that one up. But we also, we own a phone booth of our own from the 1950s in America, so that's pretty incredible. Your phone kiosk, though, is still in use, is it not?
No, it's out of use now.
I see. Yeah,
the BT came and took the telephone equipment out about a month, 6 weeks ago. And they've cut the power off, and we're not allowed to use it for telecommunications. There was a 12-page document that came with it.
Well, ours was a wood model for indoor use, and it unfortunately, it still has the inner workings and the telephone, of course, but not connected. I understand those are very, very heavy, and it's on a concrete pad, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, some people have asked me if I was going to move it, and I said, no, it's been there since 1950, and I want to leave it there, because, you know, it's a sort of a landmark. People give directions by it, you know, they pass the phone box, it's on the left.
Wow.
And, of course, you don't expect to see a phone box in the middle of nowhere. But it was used extensively in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, and then everybody started to get telephones in their houses, and now, of course, everybody's got mobiles.
Well, people walking around, perhaps using their mobile phones, could use this box you have in a refurbished form to at least have shelter while they're talking on their mobile phones.
Exactly. Yeah. But the first job is to try and track down a door. There is a company that supplies spare parts for these kiosks. But a new door is £1,000, and it's we're going to try and do some crowdfunding and see if we can raise some money to help pay for it. But $1,000 will go a long way towards helping it. Yeah.
Well, $1,000 just literally showed up on your shoreline, so we're happy. We're so happy to have played a part in that. And of course, we also said we'd donate another $1,000 to a cause of your choice, and you picked the Ocean Cleanup Campaign. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, only that I've seen it on television, and, it's something that's pretty close to my heart. I personally don't see plastic as the main problem. The main problem is people can't dispose of it properly, and so it winds up in the rivers and the waterways and then out to sea and so on. And of course, it's just devastating wildlife out there, and it's not a good scenario.
Yeah, this is an example of just how connected all of these different habitats and systems are. Given that you can send a message and get it across the ocean, and someone will find it. So that is an incredible cause, and we're all too happy to contribute. One last question: we're awful fascinated by having made contact, and
and probably will have a visit to see your part of the world. Is there a good pub or part of town? We'd love to make the visit and see what life's like there.
Well, there's a guest house next door to us. We run a very small bed and breakfast here. We have a camping body. It's in one of those pictures I sent you that sleeps 2 to 3 people. It's got all the facilities you need. We take water out and we take fuel for the stove out. And there's a little gas stove and so on. But, yeah, I mean, there's hotels in town and there's hotels in Scalloway. And there's all sorts of bed and breakfast places around. So, yeah, it's not difficult to find accommodation.
Well, Henry Anderton, thank you so much for finding our bottle and for the work that you do and just for being a real amazing representative of Shetland, the place that we certainly want to learn more about.
Well, if you ever come to Shetland, please be sure and come and see us.
We will do that. Thank you again.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Henry Anderton from Shetland talking to us after finding the bottle that we dropped into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in December of 2018. He found it earlier this month. And what an incredible story. I can't think of anybody more perfectly suited to have found the bottle. A guy cleaning up the beach, a guy who's into payphones and will use the reward money to brighten up one of those red kiosks. And I wonder, you know, maybe in Port Jefferson we have one of those doors, because actually there are two phone booths in the town next to ours. And maybe the doors are just lying around. I'm going to ask, see if somebody knows where they are.
Yeah, we'll have to find some.
Yeah.
I liked it, though. This is such a cool story, bringing so many different interesting parts of what we're always talking about together.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And the ocean cleanup campaign's really a fantastic
cause. You can find out more about that at theoceancleanup.com. We're about to donate $1,000 to them, too. We're kind of shelling out a lot of money here. I didn't really count on this happening so quickly, but it's what we said we do. And part of the penance of dropping a bottle into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is to, you know, pay something for the privilege. And I certainly feel privileged for having made this contact, having seen how long it takes a bottle to get from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean to somewhere, and learning a lot about that somewhere, too. I want to go to Shetland now.
Me, too. Yeah, we should check it out.
Yeah, sounds absolutely fascinating. I'm happy to say the bottle is back in our possession. Henry mailed it to us, and we got it in a few days. Not so happy to say that we mailed him his check last week. He still hasn't gotten it. Apparently, Postal Service from there is a lot more efficient than Postal Service from here. So hopefully he gets that. I looked it up, too. A first-class mail from the United States to other countries can take up to 3 weeks, which doesn't make any sense. I don't get that. Yeah, it's an amazing story, and I'm just so happy that it turned out that way.
Yeah, fascinating stuff, but worthwhile. I take back all of my reservations. It was really neat to be a part of, and the timing, just it was a relative long amount of time for it to travel that distance, but also quite fast, given even in the letter that the tenor and the gravity of, you know, is this thing going to make it in our lifetime and so on and so forth. Just
exactly.
How deep it got quickly in sort of a good natured letter. But it showed up a year later.
I was amazed that the bottle was completely unscathed. The label came off. Well, that's to be expected. But the insides were completely dry, and the bottle is still in perfect shape. The cap's got a little, some crustaceans or something on it? What would you say that is?
I hope so. I hope it's some kind of mineral or a barnacle, but it's either that or it's bird droppings.
Well, it could be bird droppings. It's awfully skilled of a bird to drop something onto a little bottle cap, but I guess...
Well, if that was the part sticking out of something floating in the water, maybe it was a good perch.
See, I wasn't sure when we dropped it, or when I dropped it, if it broke on contact, or if it even made it to the into the ocean, because it was at night, and we were just trying to not be seen.
And the only decks are quite a bit, I don't know how many stories, like six, maybe several stories off the surface of the water.
Yeah, I was looking up, do bottles break when they hit water from six stories up? And I wasn't sure what the outcome would be until we heard from Henry. So, wow, that is something. We'll keep you updated if any more developments happen. And, of course, if we make it over to Shetland, that would be awesome. It sounds like just such an amazing place.
An adventure waiting to happen.
Absolutely. But now it's time for our regular feature, Films of the Year That Was. As we journey back into time and watch every film that has won the Oscar for Best Film. You know, we've had the Oscar awards, the Academy Awards, in the last couple of weeks for this year, or last year, I guess. And you know what happened? The film that won Best Picture also won Best International Picture. I didn't know you could win both, but apparently that's the first time it's ever happened. We've been watching the Oscar-winning film for this country, and I just assumed the international film was just a different category. It just seems kind of weird. And in all the time that they've been awarding that, it's never won Best Picture. A foreign film has never won the Best Picture, which I think is kind of wrong. You know, if that was possible, I think it, you know, something like Bicycle Thief should have definitely won Best Film, you know, eclipsing all the American films. No way an American film has been better than a foreign film every single year until now.
Well, I think it speaks to the distribution methods and also sort of points out how distribution and theaters in general right now aren't great ways to be exposed to this kind of stuff. But the platforms and the connectedness and the ability to see different types of productions, like on a platform, a streaming platform, really make the world a smaller place. That is, if the content can actually get to people. But it is, I mean, it's the times we're living in, but also, sadly, I think, in a lot of ways, also points out how the average theater is going to show just American big budget films. There's not a lot of opportunity to go to a regular Cineplex and see international stuff and get a really wide audience.
Yeah, so there should be. There really should be.
It's really come from nowhere victories in the greater cinema. You know, people that are actually buying tickets. That audience really doesn't get exposed to this and might be caught off guard or not really understand how the opinion of the rest of the world can drive such a staid American tradition.
I still don't get why there isn't a foreign film channel. You know, somewhere on cable or satellite, we can just watch foreign films. There's no channel that does just that I know of. So if anyone out there has the means to start a cable channel, that's the one I want. That's one of the ones I want. There's a whole lot I want, actually.
Yeah. It shouldn't surprise us. It shouldn't surprise us.
Let's go to 1967. We already saw the foreign film from 1967. We already reviewed it on the show. But the domestic film for 1967, In the Heat of the Night. Yeah, with Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger. That was an incredible film. Incredible because for the first time, there was a black lead, you know, in a motion picture. And this kind of, I know it sounds ridiculous that it took that long, but this was a pivotal film. And boy, it sought to tell a lot of interesting stories as far as just racial prejudice in this country. In fact, interesting story behind it. It's supposed to take place in the town of Sparta, Mississippi. There is no Sparta, Mississippi. There is Sparta, Illinois, and that's where they actually filmed it. And the reason they did that was because they were so afraid to go down to the Deep South, and you know, for good reason too. In fact, there was one scene that had to be filmed in Tennessee where they were going through cotton fields, and filming that one scene, which took a couple of days. They were threatened. They were threatened by all kinds of rednecks and racists and things like that. So it really spoke volumes as far as what they had to go through just to make the film.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't have code names and ways of obfuscating the project. But that just speaks to just how, contentious the times were for people producing content with cast members, you know, leading roles, and one other great contribution is Quincy Jones on the music.
Oh, yes.
A fantastic arranger or composer. He does just outstanding work putting together the sounds and music that's used in so many different moods and it is incredible. There's really quirky other cast members too that really struck me. Just the character development and it reminds me a little bit of some of the avant-garde kind of a little bit like David Lynch and some of the just right. wild abstract production. A lot of close-ups, a lot of really good use of color in the lighting and so on, but it just was very intense. You got these intense characters, kooky, kind of spooky people who I think were all from the South. A lot of the supporting roles were people who were from the South and really conveyed that.
It's weird. Like the sheriff, played by Rod Steiger, reminded me so much of Carol O'Connor, you know, Archie from All in the Family. Mm-hmm. And turns out later on, years later, that's exactly who played the same character in a TV series, a TV series of In the Heat of the Night, which I never actually saw. So that was interesting right there. The characters just sort of were pretty well defined. But yeah, you know, you were in the Deep South. Even though it was filmed in Illinois, you definitely felt that. And it's you know, it's kind of a strange story because basically you have this black policeman from Philadelphia who is in this small town in Mississippi. The night a murder happens, and he, of course, is suspected by the racist rednecks who slowly start to realize that this guy is a lot smarter than they are and that they have a lot to learn from him and can work with him. And eventually he does, of course, solve the case or help solve the case. So it's you know, that sounds like something we'd be used to now, that kind of a story maybe. But then it was really, really unusual, really pivotal, and a film that I think has aged very well as far as just telling the story.
And it picks away very, very astutely at the different sort of stereotypes and the archetypes of the time,
mm-hmm.
and just does a wonderful job. I think a lot of it is the writing, too, for that sheriff. He goes on these just really vitriolic rants
mm-hmm.
about what he expects or thinks of this suspect who turns out to be an incredible investigator, and then how pious he becomes and when he's sort of put in his place, and then almost coming around as an ally, you start seeing him as a shepherd for Virgil Tibbs, leading this investigation, making sure that others know that, you know, in the medical examiner and the other offices that he's in charge, really bringing out the sort of drama of how wrong these stereotypes could be mm-hmm. in a circumstance like this.
Yeah, Virgil Tibbs, of course, being Sidney Poitier's character. And Rod Steiger does, as the sheriff, is actually start treating Virgil with respect. And, of course, that earns him the wrath of his other co-workers in the police department, as well as people in the small town who aren't quite as enlightened, even though we would not view him as that enlightened at all. Amazing story. You got to see it filmed beautifully. A lot of trains in it, too, which also is pretty amazing just to see that reproduced in the Heat of the Night. And that was 1967. Now we move to 1968. We've seen the foreign film winner from 1968. Oh, yeah. this was unbelievable because it was the first film that we've seen from the Soviet Union.
Moss film.
Yeah, it was Moscow film, something, yeah. It basically...
State production company.
It was the 1968 winner, War and Peace. 7 hours long. 7 damn hours. But wow.
431 minutes.
Yeah, and apparently there's more that we have to see too. There's another hour or so of just extra stuff. But it was incredible. It was like, to me, like watching a painting come alive. That's the best way I can describe it. You're just seeing this magnificent scenery And it's a story of Napoleon's invasion of Russia and various people that were involved in that. It gets so confusing, though, if you're trying to follow who everybody is. There's about four main characters, I guess, and you can get a pretty good sense of who they are. But
they're all dressing very much alike, and there's thousands and thousands of extras in these other scenes.
Yeah, you know, I always thought Napoleon had that, you know, the Captain Crunch type hat that he's known for, but everybody was wearing that hat, even people on the Russian side, so you didn't know who was which. I mean, I'm sure if you really study this, you'll get it, or if you're into Russian history and know the names, you'll understand it, but it's work. But it still is extremely entertaining and educational as well.
Oh, just massive undertaking, you can imagine, to produce something like this. So many different different types of photography,
mm-hmm.
and these long, lingering, stoic moments with characters where there's a lot of dialogue, maybe no dialogue, maybe stillness and simply narration from one or the other character's perspective.
Yeah.
And you also have these really just surreal flying sequences where you're going through cloudscapes, the effects. There was amazing effects on the lenses where you'd have like blurring, and it looked almost like water cascading over the camera lens.
It looked exactly like water. I think that's what it was.
Really beautiful storytelling with nature and mixing that stuff in. Again, I think a lot of surreal stuff. I think Twin Peaks, that kind of aesthetic, where or 2001, the sort of Stanley Kubrick space and the universe,
which came out the same year,
connecting. Yeah, that imagination and artfulness is just runs throughout when you're not enveloped in the story or the fighting or the characters battling it out.
You know, you don't realize this, but so many people were influenced by this film, and you may not know that, because when have you ever seen this film? Well, I'll tell you when you might have seen this film. I remember as a kid, this aired on American television, not on PBS, on ABC. Yeah, I remember this. Four nights of a week were devoted to War and Peace from the Soviet Union. It was dubbed, but I remember in my house, excitement over War and Peace being on television. I wonder, does anybody out there remember this? Does anybody remember 1972 is when it aired on ABC? Can you imagine that today, where a Russian film airing for four nights on a commercial television network in this country, a commercial broadcast network? That's all we had back then. And it got a lot of attention. I'm just wondering, does anybody else remember that? Because I didn't realize that until we started watching it, and I looked it up, and I found out, yeah, this actually was aired, and my memory was actually correct in this particular case. There was a PBS version that aired around the same time. That took a whole lot of weeks. It was a weekly production, and that was from, I think, BBC Two. But this was the actual original one from the Soviet Union. It just is incredible to me that I'm kind of reliving that part of my childhood. I didn't pay any attention to it when I was that young, but I was aware of it happening. And I think everybody was. So that was simply incredible. I mentioned four nights. It's divided into four parts. So we saw one film a night. The first one, Andrei Bolkonsky was the title. Andrei was this, I guess, nobleman who went off to war couple of times and was involved in romantic adventures and things like that. Second part, Natasha Rostova. Now, that's interesting because Natasha, the way they confuse you, they call her Natalie sometimes. They call her Natashka. And Natasha and Natalia, I think, was another version.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the same name. It just was driving me crazy. And I learned this. Her last name, Rostova. Well, the family is called Rostov. I realize they add A's to the end of Russian names when it's a female. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
I did not know that. So I learned that from this film. And then part three, the year 1812. You might have heard of 1812, you know, with the overture and all that. That was a big year when Napoleon rolled into Moscow and then rolled out afterwards when winter hit. And then part four, Pierre Bezukhov. which was another character.
The illegitimate son.
He was a bastard. And he was a guy that just seemed to always get in the way. But we kind of saw everything through his eyes as well. So, interesting story. 1,500-page book, if you really want to get into it. But a seven-hour film. And it was...
epic.
It's amazing that we got through this in a week.
Incredible. Yeah, it was... I think it's worth trying to watch again. I don't know how you do that. I guess another week you block out, but just so cool to see and revisit this and see it really for the first time, this story. I haven't ventured to read the book, but I know the history. I know some of the history there. And again, the way it's told through this family, it is fascinating to just see it unfold over a really slow amount of time. It's this slow, careful study of the history through this family's perspective. The other color, there's so many colors and great visuals, but the color green really yeah. stands out. The way it's used in different scenes, it's really a profound epic. And the Soviets or Moss film outdid itself, I would say.
Really did. And you would think that a country that was communist, like the Soviet Union, anti-religion, would treat religion badly. They don't. They treat religion with incredible respect and reverence. And it's such a moving story just to watch the scenery, watch things like, oh, this was amazing. Moscow burning. Because that's what the people decided to do. Rather than let the French get it, they decided to burn down Moscow. While this is happening, I think the last film, the Pierre Bazukov, Pierre Bazukov, part four of four, go 33 minutes into that film. What I heard was simply amazing. If you ever listen to Revolution 9 by the Beatles from the White Album, I heard stuff that they got from the film. They used sound from War and Peace in that piece, in that weird backwards song that the Beatles put out and really kind of annoyed a lot of people. But they used bits from War and Peace because everybody was influenced by this in one way or another. So I thought that was... That was simply an incredible discovery right there. I recognized it from someplace, and all of a sudden, wow, this is where they got it from. Anyway, that's going to do it for our reviews of the films of the year that was. And that year, 1968, going to move on to 1968 domestic film, which we'll review when we're back on the air, which I think will be in a couple of 3 weeks, maybe?
Yes, 3 weeks or whenever. If not, then maybe sooner.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. But, hey, you know what's a good idea? How about we go out with the theme to In the Heat of the Night as sung by Ray Charles, arranged by Quincy Jones?
Okay.
You up for that?
I think.
All right.
Let's do it.
Hit it, Ray.
In the heat of the night, seems like a cold sweat creeping across my brow. Yeah, in the heat of the night, I'm feeling motherless somehow. Stars with evil eyes stare from the skies. All mean and bright.
In the heat of the night,
ain't a woman yet been born. Knows how to make the morn sell my soul for just a little light
in the heat of the night.
In the heat of the night,
got trouble wall to wall. Oh, yes, I have. I repeat in the night. Must be an ending to it all. Just you be strong, and it'll be all.